Mr. Boxall, reel two. How much difference is there between being a parachutist and being an ordinary infantryman in an ordinary infantry regiment?
A parachutist, in my view, parachuting is only a means of getting anywhere. An infantryman would have probably gone by boat or gone by vehicle. Parachutist went in an airplane and jumped out. But once you got on the ground, there was an awful difference because you had no transport. Everything you had, you carried. If you had, when you jumped out an airplane, if you had a 3-inch mortar, if you were in the 3-inch mortars, you had to jump out with a 3-inch mortar, part of a 3-inch mortar strapped to your leg and in a bag and then lowered underneath you. So everything that you needed, you carried. One or two, we had collapsible barrows and things like that, but mainly, once you got on the ground, it was a hard slog of carrying everything you wanted and everything you needed. And that was the same in Normandy. When we landed in Normandy, you landed with everything that you could need. If you hadn't got it, you didn't have it.
So did you have to be more muscular to be a parachute?
Well, you had to be fitter, obviously. I mean, we used to do things like a 5-mile or a 10-mile march in 2 hours every week, 2 miles in 17 minutes every week, and then about every 2 weeks we used to do a 15 or 20 or 30-mile route march. And when we were training for Normandy, we did those, carrying everything as we would go into battle.
Was anybody injured in the training?
Well, yes, you had your injuries. People were injured in parachuting, broken legs and concussion and things like that. And the conditions were bad. And, of course, there were the usual strains and sprains and knocks that you got from all the soldiers.
Do you remember anybody being killed in the training?
Not that I know of. Obviously, people were killed, but not very. I saw, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of parachutes descent, and I never once saw anyone that badly injured.
Did you feel confident in the arrangements and in the people who were responsible for the safety of your parachute equipment?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you would. Once again, we only had one parachute. There was no reserve parachute or anything like that. You only had one parachute. And that was, if you hadn't, you obviously had confidence in the WAFs and the people who packed the parachutes and the way they were looked after and everything. And once again, I never saw one that completely did not open. I've seen them partially with a line thrown over the canopy and only partially open, but I never saw one that didn't open.
Did the parachute equipment change very much whilst you were in training?
No, it was the basic parachute or static it was, because it was on a static line. And we first had 10 men in an aeroplane with an old Whitley with a hole in the floor, and you sat on your behind and scraped your way along and put your feet into the hole when it was your turn and got through. But then later on they used Dakotas, and we had Dakotas with they never had a door on the side. The door was taken off, and so it would open. And when the time came to jump, you got up 20 of you and walked down the plane and jumped out. And that was the same in Normandy. We had Dakotas there, and that was the same. Only, of course, out there it was a night landing. And
were all the parachutes identical?
Yes, yeah. The only smaller ones were those that were used for things like motorbikes that were in small motorbikes, Royal Enfield motorbikes we used to have, and dogs. We had one or two war dogs with us that were in smaller parachutes. Ours, I think, were 28-foot parachutes, and the ones they used for the dogs and that were 18-foot canopies. But they were all basically very much the same.
So you didn't have any especially big parachutes?
No. No, those big parachutes that you now, or did see a few years ago, was where they were dropping things like jeeps and small tanks and things like that. We never had that. That was just the men who jumped. And the biggest thing that could be that could come down with you would be a motorbike on a parachute. Jeeps and things like that came in gliders.
Did you know what you were training for as a para?
Oh, yes. We all knew that we were going to be employed on D-Day without a shadow of a doubt. And we practiced some months before for various operations that were going to go on.
Can you take me through, step by step in detail, the preparations you made for D-Day, please?
Well, the 9th Para Battalion was going to attack the a battery on the coast, and I was in 3 Para Brigade Headquarters Defence Platoon, and the REs constructed this mock-up of this battery, and we manned it for the 9th Para Battalion to practice attacking it. Things like that. You did all sorts of things to get yourself ready for the actual day. There were exercises and parachute drops, and people were mock wounded, and the medics had to look after them. And it was all the general training to get the units and the division ready to go into action when it was needed.
What rank did you have by the time that you went to Normandy?
I was a corporal when we went to Normandy. We flew from an airfield called Dalhampton. I think it was about 11 o'clock in the evening when we went, when we boarded the Dakota. And that was 1:30. When I landed, I was actually on the ground at 1:30 in the morning, on D-Day morning.
What was your parachute descent like?
All right. I jumped out, and I was stick commander, which was number 20, and my number 19 was underneath my feet. I'd gone out so quick, and we landed in a field. Could almost have touched hands when we landed, and. It was dark, obviously. I reckoned that we'd missed a D-Day and were south of it, and I collected about a dozen or so chaps who were milling about trying to find out where to go, and I collected them together, and I worked out we needed to go north, so we headed north. And luckily, by about 6:30 in the morning, before it got light, about 4 or 5 o'clock, we were at a chateau that was called Chateau Barreville, which was our rendezvous point. And we waited there for the remainder to come through, and we joined up with the Power Brigade Headquarters.
What was the atmosphere like in the Dakota as you were going across?
Oh, well, it was quiet, I suppose. You could say, you know, everybody had their own thoughts about it. I think mostly it was quiet, and people sort of just sat there and kept their thoughts to themselves.
What was going through your mind?
From this distance in time, I don't really know. I suppose we were apprehensive, the same as everybody. I mean, the first time in action, none of us, I don't think, have been in action before. But once we got over the coast of Normandy, of course, with the anti-aircraft fire and coming up and stuff going down, because Air Force were bombing prior to us dropping, when we got over the coast of Normandy, it looked quite a pretty sight, really, but more like firework night than anything else.
Did people ever take alcohol before the...
No. We had, we obviously had sweets and things like that in the aircraft, but we refused. But no, I don't think any, well, I, as far as I'm aware, nobody had alcohol. They may have done, but I don't, as far as I'm aware, they didn't.
Were you told not to?
No, I don't think that was even thought about. I don't think our the senior NCOs and our officers didn't even consider that we would need to be... drunk or anything like that that's going to do the job that we were going to do. We were all there, we were going to do the job that we'd been trained to do, and the training was good, and we were going to do what we had to do. I don't think any of us needed anything but bolster our spirits.
What equipment did you personally take?
I took a stand gun. I had pouches, well, you had rations in your pack, you had all the kit that you needed, that you normally carried, plus we had, you had extra ammunition that you had to carry, you had extra Bren magazines, because the Bren guns in the platoon had to have magazines carried for them. The final thing that was given to me, that I had to take, was a roll of parachute aircraft recognition suit, and that was quite a fair size roll, and the only place I could find for it was in the top of my jumping jacket, and I tucked it in the top, and that was the only place, because you had to carry a spade and a pick and an anti-tank mine. And
what colour was the aircraft recognition suit?
I think it was a sort of pinky colour, but it was there were strips of them, and they were sort of laid out in different formations so that the Air Force could see whether they were, we were the people they shouldn't attack, I think, I hope, anyway.
You said that your rendezvous was this chateau. Can you tell me what you found when you got there?
Well, there was nothing. That was quiet. There were no enemy there, and we laid outside the chateau. We didn't actually go there into the chateau itself. We laid outside and waited until the brigade HQ and the rest of the battalion came through and joined up with them.
What happened once you made contact with them?
We then moved to a farm near a place called Limenil, and there we were. That was up on the on a ridge, wooded ridge. And on D plus one the evening, we had a marvellous view of the air landing brigade flying in. They flew in at 9 o'clock at night and landed on down in the valley in front of us, and we could see the tow aircraft and the gliders breaking loose and then coming into land. It was quite a sight, really. But then on D plus six, I think it was, on the 12th of June, I was out on an outpost with my section, and we were shelled, and I got a piece of shrapnel in the leg.
How exactly did it happen?
I think I'm told that the shell hit the tree above us. I don't remember much about it, really. All I remember was being eventually carried back into brigade headquarters to the RAP, the first aid post, and the doctor looking at my leg and saying, right, evacuation.
Whereabouts in the leg did it hit you?
Just above the knee. I've got a fair sized hole in my knee.
This is your left leg?
Yeah. And that put me out of action. I was taken back to the beachhead to be evacuated, and finished up in the tented hospital in our branches, where they operated on me that night, because they thought that the shrapnel had cut the tendon in my leg. But luckily it hadn't. It had cut the capsule that the tendon travels in, I'm told. But it hadn't cut the tendon, so... instead of amputating my leg, I was left with it.
What had happened to you between D-Day and the time when you were wounded?
Well, we'd had various patrols, gone out on patrols, and done guard duties, looking after brigade headquarters, various jobs, going to help the brigade ordnance warrant officer collect stores and things like that. All the general duties that the soldiers had to do.
What did you think to the enemy opposition in Normandy?
Once they realised that we were there in force, I think they looked out of it. Obviously they put up stiff resistance to begin with. But and of course I wasn't there then, but once we got really going, I think a lot of the German soldiers themselves were realised that their idea of winning the war had finished.
Did you see any of their prisoners?
Not then, I didn't. I did later on when we went back to, after I'd been home and I'd been in hospital for a couple of months, met my wife who was a nurse at Beverly Hospital in Yorkshire. But I find after about 3 months I was fit again, went back to Bulford to the brigade headquarters, and we were then in December, suddenly a couple of days before Christmas, were moved back to the war because the Germans had broken through in the what was eventually called the Battle of the Bulge. And we were rushed out to the Ardennes to sort of plug the gap.
What did you think of the medical treatment you got for your wound?
Oh, very good. I was treated. The hospitals did everything they possibly could for you. When I was wounded, the RAMC did everything they possibly could for you. Undoubtedly, a lot of people owe their lives to the RAMC and the hospitals during the war.
So, you returned to the unit for the Ardennes.
Yeah.
What was your job when you rejoined them?
I went back to being a corporal in charge of a section. And the same thing in the Ardennes, it was looking after security brigade headquarters, doing all the jobs that soldiers do. We went to give one of the platoons of one of the power battalions a break. So we went up into the line for 2 or 3 weeks when we moved up to the River Maas in Holland after the Battle of the Bulge was over.
What was it like in the line on the River Maas?
It was cold and wet, we were one side of the River Maas and the Germans were the other side. Occasional shelling and machine gun fire and all the normal things that happen in a war.
Did you go out on patrol?
Yes, yeah. I used to go out on patrol most nights and patrol right up to the River Maas. Some patrols went across the Maas. I wasn't on one of those, but some patrols did. We were occupied buildings just on the bank of the Maas, and you tried to keep a watch on what was going on the other side of the river.
Did you have any contact with the Dutch population?
No, very little, because I think they were mostly moved out, were kept back out of the way rather than being right up close to the river side where the sort of front was in.
What was the local settlement or village that was near you on the River Maas?
I think it was called Hyde Susan, but how you spell it, I wouldn't know.
Did you say that it was then that you saw German prisoners?
Yes, we saw some then. Yes, we did see German prisoners. They seemed a motley crowd. A lot of them were old men, and most of them seemed to be pleased that they'd been captured rather than having to go on fighting.
How were they treated?
They were treated far better than they would have treated us.
Did you ever see any of them roughed up?
No. No.
Now, coming into 1945, can you tell me about your experiences on the continent then, please?
Yes, we came home from, we were sent back home again from up on the River Mars. I think we got home on the 21st or 22nd of February. Had leave. And on the 22nd or 23rd of March, we were back over again doing a parachute landing crossing the line, where we flew from an airfield in Essex. And I was told at the time that the air armada was so large that it wouldn't be able to form up until we got over the continent. We obviously were in the van of the armada. We landed over Rhine, down onto the DZ. I was unlucky that I was in between two trees, about 30 foot up off the ground. But I managed to cut myself free and get down onto the ground, joined up with my section of platoon. And we moved off the DZ after about a couple of hours into our flight positions where we were going to consolidate the landing.
How much enemy fire did you experience in the Rhine?
On our DZ, I think, I believe afterwards they took about 300 odd of our dead off our DZ. I believe that there was an opposed landing and part of the wood was occupied by the Germans, so there was the first people that landed landed into a firefight with quite considerable
ferocity. Did any of the enemy fire come near you?
Once or twice I got fired at, but luckily they didn't hit me.
How did your equipment that you took for the Rhine crossing compare with the equipment that you took for...
It was virtually the same. There was no... We hadn't... it was virtually the same sort of stuff that we took when we went to Normandy. Of course, this time there wasn't a possibility that we were going to be stranded for a couple of days on our own because the crossing, once we got across, the main army could get across behind us. So we weren't in anticipating being sort of cut off for about a couple of days like we were in Normandy. As it happens, we weren't cut off in Normandy, but we could have been. But over the Rhine, it was a different, entirely different thing. It was. We landed about 10 o'clock in the morning, and by the next morning, the main army had started crossing the line and was catching up with us.
How did you feel about doing a daylight drop as opposed to a night drop?
A daylight drop was a bit easier, but then that was a bit easier for the enemy to see them fire at you. It's one of those things again, there's no choice, you've got to do it. It ain't no good saying, well, it looks dangerous. I'm not going. Once you're in the airplane, once you get outside the door, there's no going back. In fact, I found, and I've said this to many people since, that having seen films and that, of those people who went over the beaches in Normandy, going in by parachute was far, far less dangerous. I always look at those films of them going over the beach and think to myself, God, that would be really dangerous. I'm glad I didn't do that. And I found that, as I said before, parachuting, I think really it was just a means of getting there. It was another way of transport, another means of transport. Alright, it might look a bit more dangerous, but...
But you are totally helpless as you're descending.
Yes, but you're not in the air for very long. We used to start jumping from 600 feet. And there were 20 to get out, and the airplane was diving slightly all the time. So by the time I got out of number 20, was probably down to 400 feet, not in the airborne, not very long at all. And with the numbers that were coming down, they couldn't hit all of them.
Did you know of people who were hit while they were descending?
No, I didn't. Of course, you don't find that because they're probably collected by other people. I didn't know of anybody who were hit when they were descending. Obviously, some people were fired at, and a lot of, as I say, on our DZ, there were quite a number of our troops killed. I think there was over 300. But once again, they're dead, and although it might be hard-hearted to say so now, you just pass them by and go and get on with the job you're doing. If they're wounded, you can do something for them. Once they're dead, there's nothing much you can do, and it's not your job to do it anyway. Your job is to get on and do the job that you're there to do.
How upsetting did you find casualties in your own unit?
You don't. Because, as I say, once again, you know, it was a normal occurrence. Once you got into action, someone was going to get killed, and someone was going to have to deal with it, and eventually they were going to have to be buried. As I say, it sounds callous probably, but you're there to do a job, and people are killed. I've had members of my section killed. You don't break down weeping over it. You just get on and say, well, we've got a job to do, let's get on and do it.
What kind of terrain did you land in Germany?
It was wooded, just over the Rhine. There was quite a fair sized wood on our DZ, but it was open countryside. I mean, it was like farmland.
Did anybody get caught up in the trees?
I was up between two trees when the parachute hooked up over the top of a tree, but I managed to cut myself free and slide down the trunk of the tree and get on the ground.
What did parachutists feel about landing in woodland?
One of those things that you had to do. One of these hazards that are there, and you get over them.
But the drop was more accurate.
Yes, we got it. It was a lot more accurate. The planes could see, the pilots could see where we were, where they got to drop us, and they got us there. It was a lot more accurate. But in Normandy, the advanced parties that were supposed to lay out the DZs didn't get there, so the pilots didn't have anything to hone in on them. Whereas in over Rhine, it was daylight. They could see the DZ. The first people down had got it marked so that everything was, it was easy for them to drop them exactly where they needed to.
Can you tell me about what happened once you'd landed in the DZ?
We went and got made our positions. And after a few days with consolidation, it was a general advance through Germany. We moved up through Germany, up to the River Elbe, over the River Elbe, and up to a place called Wismar, up on the Baltic coast.